You're listening to Sion Radio with me, Andrew David. It's always a pleasure to welcome guests, even though we're still working remotely, to Sion. We do so by using the magic that is Zoom. Sometimes I'm zooming across the other side of the country. Sometimes I'm zooming across the other side of the world with American cousins, with Bruce K. Rosenblum. Today, I can actually look out of my window, look east, and, well, if he's got his window, I can wave at our next guest, Alex Roddy. Alex, are you there?
Hello, Andrew. Yes, I'm there.
And waving, gesticulating. No, you're not waving, just in case people are thinking he's lost the plot. The reason I say that is that I'm just south of Lincoln and you're just outside Skegness.
That's right, in Barrow-le-Marsh.
Very nice indeed. So yeah. We have our own local author. The reason we're talking today is something that's going to transport us to, and we've just had a little pre-chat, somewhere where I reckon is almost a completely different country. We're going to be looking at the northwest of Scotland in and around the Cape Ruth area, which you are just about to launch a fabulous book. And if anybody wants a sort of taster of it, they could quickly Google Alex Roddy and have a look for your previous visit to Cape Ruth, or one of your other visits to Cape Ruth, which you did in February. So Alex, welcome to Sion. Thank you so much indeed for spending time with us. Tell us about the book and how it came about.
Sure. Well, I've long been a long distance hiker. So one of the things I love to do the best is to take my rucksack and tent into the hills and just basically walk for as long as I want, you know, anything between a few days and a few weeks. And one of the best places for me to go and do this kind of thing is the Highlands of Scotland. And I think the Highlands are fantastic for backpacking because you do have the legal right to wild camp. There's been a lot of bad press about so-called dirty camping over the last year, but this is mostly from people who don't know how to behave in the great outdoors. And if you do it responsibly, wild camping is genuinely fantastic, you know, kind of taking everything you need for a night on the hill and leaving no trace that you're ever there. And in the Scottish Highlands, you can string together routes lasting up to a couple of weeks or even more if you want to. So I've done quite a few routes of that kind in the Scottish Highlands over the years. But the route that really called to me for a long time was a long distance trail called the Cape Ruth Trail. And this starts in Fort William. The traditional version starts in Fort William. And it extends for about 250 miles, give or take, to Cape Ruth, which is the northwesternmost point of the British mainland. And it's pretty much the wildest and most challenging route you can do in the Scottish Highlands. You can, of course, invent your own very difficult challenges if you want. But of the established long distance trails, this is the big one. I've done it twice now, as you say, once in summer conditions, and then I went back a few years later and I did it in winter.
Now, the one I saw was when you did it in winter, and yeah. The early part of your writing up of it and the pictures said you had such a bad night, your tent almost collapsed and you had to get your brother to bring out a spare tent.
Yes.
That's a good start.
Yeah, it was an inauspicious start. Let's say that much. The problem was I had a lot of test kit along because I do a lot of work for outdoor magazines.
Right.
And I'm always testing review equipment. And this particular tent, I hadn't actually had a chance to test it properly before the trip. it was kind of one of those things where I took it along and hoped it would be fine, and it wasn't.
Oh, bless. Now, you see, you talk about your attraction to an absolutely spectacular part of the United Kingdom mainland.
Yeah.
And you talk about the love of the raw, because based in Barrow-le-Marsh and not too far away from the Wolds, that's about as hilly as it gets, isn't it?
Yeah, there's not a huge amount of mountainous terrain around here. Although, you know, the Wolds do have their moments, you know.
Oh,
definitely.
They do. They absolutely do.
Yeah.
I want to go back on a couple of things before we talk a bit more about the book. You talk
sure.
about wild camping and that there's been lots of criticism about dirty camping. I'm assuming dirty camping is as much about leaving refuse around and I suppose other things, because with wild camping, you haven't got a campsite with facilities on it. So can I ask you the delicately indelicate question, what do you do with the human stuff that you have to somehow get rid of?
Sure. Well, that is a very good question. And it's something a lot of people wonder about when thinking about wild camping. And the simple answer is essentially you dig a small hole, you know, you go a reasonable distance from a path and any water courses, you dig a hole, you do what you have to do, and then you fill it in again. And, you know, if you're doing your job right, nobody will tell that you were ever there.
Okay, we've sorted that one out. Yeah. And the other thing is, in terms of, there's a picture of you, and I think really people ought to listen to this interview and have a look at your previous blog about it, because there's some phenomenal pictures. And there's also pictures of you absolutely, well, wrapped up with all your rucksacks and your poles and things. I mean, there's a huge amount you're just taking just for you, isn't there?
Yes, there is. I try to keep a lightweight pack where possible, but there's only so much you can do in winter, to be honest. I mean, in summer, I tend to go with a much lighter rucksack. In winter, on the Cape Wrath Trail, I was generally carrying about 20 to 25 kilograms. It makes itself felt on the shoulders, let's put it that way.
How do you deal with, I mean, you do stop at Bothies and other places like that, but when you're out wild camping, what sort of food rations do you take? Do you take these rations that are reconstituted with water and things like that?
Often I will, yes. On the Cape Wrath Trail in particular, in the winter trip, I almost entirely ate pre-prepared freeze-dried rations, simply because they're much lighter. Mm. So they have all the moisture removed. That means they're as light as they can possibly be. And it also made them easy to send them in resupply parcels. I had a few kind of drop-off points arranged along the trip. Kind of, there was a couple of youth hostels that were open and kind of B&Bs and stuff that had agreed to take in food parcels. Because of course you wouldn't be able to carry all the food you needed right from the start.
Absolutely. It is a breathtaking part of the world. But it is, even in the summer, it is, because it's on the western side, if you've got some Atlantic weather systems coming in, you are going to be lashed by rain. And even in the summer, it can be fairly challenging, I would have thought.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the weather in the West Highlands really can be abysmal. I mean, I have hiked in the West Highlands before and it's rained every day for 2 weeks. It's kind of something that I won't say you get used to it, because you never really get used to it, but you almost learn to appreciate the grimness. But in winter, it does get worse. I mean,
and of course, and of course, the weather has formed what it looks like. You know, that is essentially part of why it looks so wonderful and wild, and then occasionally unbelievably lush and verdant.
Yes, that's correct. You know, it's a very wet landscape. That's integral to the both the geography and the wildlife as well, and everything that you see. Really, in the book, I almost mentioned that it feels more like a waterscape that I'm walking across than a landscape, because the water affects everything. You know, there's water everywhere.
There's one bit on the, not in the book, because I'm so looking forward to seeing it, but in your online article, you say that it was raining so hard that the paths were the rivers. You know, you were walking in a river because it was just so unbelievably wet.
That's a very commonplace experience in the West Highlands. The paths tend to be, they're not kind of constructed paths or anything, so they tend to be water eroded, and that means they do tend to turn into streams in wet weather.
What about safety and security? I'm assuming that you've got all sorts of GPS devices, and you obviously let people know where you are and where you're aiming to get to. What about mobile coverage and things like that? How good is that?
Yeah, mobile coverage is very spotty along that trip. One of the things that I deliberately did for this particular trip is I wanted to stay off the internet for the entire duration. That was kind of almost a separate issue. I wanted to work out what it would feel like to go offline for an extended period, because it's not really something we ever do these days. But in terms of safety, I did make sure I checked in with my wife by text message and phone call wherever I could, which in practice was sometimes only once every few days. But I also carried a satellite tracker device called a spot tracker, and I used that to send in daily check-in pings. So I'd press a button and it would send a ping to my wife and a few other family members and friends just to say, here I am, I'm safe. But it just, it doesn't always work. It doesn't have 100% reliability, so you can't kind of completely rely on it. It does have an SOS function, though, which you can use. I've obviously never used it, but theoretically you push the SOS button and it will summon a rescue within a few hours, which is kind of a nice lifeline should you need it.
And you're a professional at this. I mean, this is the sort of thing that people really need to think about. Especially if they're, you know, the recent great weather has tempted them to say, oh, well, let's get in the car and go off somewhere. I mean, even if it's somewhere to the Derbyshire Dales or the Yorkshire Dales, they need to think ahead just in case, because we're forecasting some very heavy showers coming our way, and they can really make a big, big difference. So even having a small pack of bits, if you're going on a moderate little walk, is a great idea.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily suggest taking a satellite tracker to the Peak District or anything like that. But, you know, you're quite correct. You know, making sure that not only your phone has got a full charge, but carry a portable battery pack. They're very cheap. And waterproof jacket, map and compass, very important. You know, phones don't always work. You know, there's not always signal. You're going to want a proper map to know where you are and where you're going.
Let's get back to the book, and particularly a line that I've been struck by, certainly in the pre-publicity. You wanted to get away from the internet.
Yes.
Dare I ask why?
Oh, it's a big question, really. I'm in my mid-30s, and I'm of that generation where when I was a child, the internet didn't exist, but I very much grew up with it growing all around me. So when I was in my mid-teens and going to university, the internet was dramatically increasing in its influence on everyone's lives. And I sometimes think that my generation has got a unique relationship with the internet, in that we remember what it was like beforehand, but we don't remember what it was like to be an adult beforehand. And I really struggled to kind of form a sensible relationship with the internet, as it were. So, for example, at university, I found it very difficult a lot of the time to focus on the work I was supposed to be doing. I would spend a lot of time procrastinating on the internet. And as I moved into my current freelance writing and editing career, I continued having focus issues, and it also anxiety as well, possibly related to the freelance work that I do, possibly related to elements of my experience online, you know, spending too much time on Twitter and the like. And I started to wonder, you know, what would actually happen if I completely stepped away from it? Because as an adult, I had never completely stepped away from it for more than 2 or 3 days during those signal black spots we mentioned. So I thought, let's just do an experiment. Let's just completely leave it behind for, you know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and see how it affects my thinking. Just see what happens, essentially.
You mentioned your wife, and you mentioned you do these ping things, or you check in. How did she feel about the whole concept of you going cold turkey on the internet?
She understands me well, so she knew why I had to do it. But at the same time, it was challenging for her, because you know, at the time, my mother was going through a very difficult time, because my dad died a year before the trip, and she lived just around the corner from us in Borough. And so Hannah had to kind of deal with all that, as well as her own business. She's the florist in Borough. So she had to do that while not being in contact with me much of the time. You know, that convenience of just sending a quick message wasn't there anymore. So if she had something she needed to tell me, or if she was just worrying about how I was doing or where I was, she had to wait until my next phone call, which could be who knew when. She'd get the pings, which would come through 90% of the time, but that doesn't tell you much apart from I'm not dead and this is where I am. So it was challenging for her, yeah, definitely.
I hope this is in the book, but what I also want to find out is whether you felt better at the end of the trip through having come off the internet, and whether you've carried that with you onwards.
That's a very complex question. I felt different. I think that's the best way I can put it. I felt very different. So it only took about a week or so for my thoughts, or just my pattern of thinking, to change completely. So it's something that I only really noticed by its contrast beforehand, my thoughts had been very fragmented, you know, flitting from subject to subject. I always had so many things to do, so many things to think about. And because I'd start the day by looking at the news, by logging onto Twitter, which I use for work as well, there'd be constantly, you know, loads of people's opinions flooding into my head. After a week on the trail, after a week of not being exposed to that information fire hose, my thoughts felt a lot more linear and a lot slower. And it's something I can best describe as the kind of experience of being really engrossed in a good book. But rather than just being like feeling like that for short periods of time, that was just how my mind felt all the time. But I can't say that I finished the trail thinking, yes, this is excellent. This is how I want to live now. Far from it. I think, in fact, the trip almost made me realize many of the things that I took for granted about my experience on the internet, many of the things that I really appreciated that I didn't realize I appreciated before the trip. So it provided a big reset in terms of perspective, but it has helped me to be more intentional with my use of the internet. And I tend to keep distracting websites such as Twitter and the U siloed into particular times of day. And I don't multitask as often with, you know, like a Twitter window open and Facebook and everything else when I'm trying to work, because I just can't do that. That's one of the key things I learned about myself when I was on the trip. I need to focus on one thing at a time.
Did your wife notice any difference in you when you came back?
She's not actually said, to be honest.
I ought to pop into the florist and ask her.
Yeah, I think she does notice a difference. I mean, I always feel very different when I come back from these big trips. I mean, this isn't the biggest trip I've done, but it's probably the most significant in terms of how it's changed my thinking. So yeah, after every time I go into the hills for a few days, I will come back noticeably calmer and kind of just a bit kind of chilled out and in that zen-like state. It doesn't always last for very long, but I'm sure she notices.
I love your expression about being in the fire hose of the internet and having, because it really does come at you with that sort of power, and it can overwhelm a lot of people, and it becomes obsessive. And I'm so unbelievably jealous of what you've done. And the interesting thing is, listening to you talking, people know that I'm 67, so I'm all but double your age. Mm. So I grew up not having computers. I grew into computers. I've grown into the internet, and we can't be doing this. I can't be running my radio station without that technology. But I do like it when I log off and I go into the garden and I listen to the birds, or we go for a walk around the lovely parkland we have here, because I think it is necessary for people to realize how obsessive something like that can become, and dangerous and somewhat demonic, I think.
I completely agree. And I think for me, many aspects of the internet can be almost like a personal confirmation bias machine. You know, it reinforces beliefs, and it kind of turns thoughts inwards. It can be great for connecting with people. You know, as you say, there are many, many advantages. And, you know, I've made many valuable friendships and work connections online. But I think if you spend too much time there, and I mean, I work from home, I work on my computer. So it's always that risk. You know, it's very easy to slip back into old habits. And I you know, many people will be in the same situation. If they're working from home for the first time, they may kind of feel that temptation to just spend a bit too long just listlessly scrolling. And it can do subtle, not necessarily damage, that's not necessarily the right word, but it certainly can affect you. And I agree, you definitely need to have that ability to log off, and the presence of mind to log off, because of course the default nowadays is for everything to be constantly online. You know, we're not in the dial-up days where you have to press a button and wait for the pings to stop, and then you're on the internet and you're spending money, you know, every second. It's a lot different nowadays. The internet's kind of the ocean in which we swim.
Alex, you're showing your age talking about dial-up. You may have to explain that to some of our younger listeners. And that funny noise that we used to have. And in fact, of course, in Lincolnshire, where you and I both are, we are troubled by some of the country's slowest internet connections. But let's not go there. Let's simply end by saying the book isn't out yet. So two things are going to happen from now onwards. People are going to go to your website and have a look at this wonderful journey that you've already got on there, which is not actually what the book is. The book is called The Farthest Shore. It's out on the 2nd of September. Can people pre-order it now?
Yes, that's right. So it's published by Vertebrate Publishing, and you can either go onto their website or there's a link to it on my homepage, and it's available to pre-order right now. And if you pre-order it directly through them, you get a 20% discount, or you can also pre-order it on Amazon as well, but I'd recommend going straight to the publisher.
Yes, spoken like a well trained in the promotional art. Now, just to so everybody knows, they heard you say vertebrate. How do you spell that?
Vertebrate. I think I've got that right.
I'm just trying to double check as well on the emails that have come in, and I can't find vertebrate.
Yes, as you'd spelled, you know, the backbone.
as in yeah. Invertebrate. Lovely. That's yes. Lovely. And it's called the Father's Shot, I suppose. I need to ask you, how much is it going to cost?
That's a good question, actually. I'm not 100% sure. I think it's probably $14.99 the full price, but as I say, 20% off for the pre-orders. So
excellent. Lovely. Yeah. It's been a real pleasure, Alex, to talk to you. I love walking, and this has inspired me to think about being a bit bolder, not necessarily this year, but maybe next year, to do something a little bit more challenging. It would be lovely to keep in touch. It would be lovely to eventually get you into our studios in Lincoln, if we ever get back to them. So for the moment, Alex Roddy, thank you so much indeed for joining us here on Sarum Radio. The book is called The Farthest Shore. Vertebrate is the website you need to go to, because you get 20% if you pre-order. Can I thank you very much indeed? I need to ask you finally, what's your next big project?
Well, next big project, next year I am planning to do a very big long distance hike in the Alps, if, you know, restrictions allow. I've got this big trip brewing kind of across the entire Swiss Alps and Italian Alps, but we'll have to see how COVID pans out. A lot could change between now and then.
And you'll no doubt have to test drive your tent a little bit more thoroughly than you did a couple of years ago. Alex Roddy, thank you so much indeed for spending time with us here on Sarum Radio.
And thank you for having me. Cheers.